It's Sunday morning with me, Ricky Ross. Coming up, it's something we all want, but what is happiness and where can we find it? Some suggestions later. But first, Alistair McIntosh is a world-leading environmental campaigner and author and has taught spiritual activism in Europe, North America, Australia, Indonesia, Moscow and Beirut. His new book is called Spiritual Activism, Leadership as Service, co-written by Matt Carmichael. And I should also add, Alistair's a good friend of us here on Sunday mornings, and it's great to welcome him back. Good morning, Alistair.
Good morning, Ricky, and everybody.
Tell me, what is spiritual activism?
Oh, well, what is activism, first of all? Activism is being active in the world. It's being out there. It's trying to change what's wrong with the world, including changing what's wrong within ourselves. Most activism is carried out at a social or political level, and so often that runs dry. People either burn out or sell out because they're not tapping into the deeper roots of what it means to be a human being. And that's what I think of as our spirituality, our deeper connection, ultimately with the divine, which can resource the work that we do in the world.
What kind of person is likely to become a spiritual activist?
In my experience, Ricky, either somebody who is conventionally religious, whose whole framing of life is through their religion, or somebody who has engaged with activism in the world, usually for social justice or environmental sustainability, that kind of thing, and has found themselves so up against it that they're running on empty all the time. They're lonely with what they're doing. They're often ostracized by friends or colleagues because they're standing up and standing out. And they either have to give up on it, become exhausted by it, or they have to tap into this deeper level of resourcing, which is the spiritual life that gives life.
I'm wondering now, Alistair, in your case, you know, you have become an activist. Was it something with you which was thrust upon you that just emerged, or do you think you were born such a person?
That's a difficult one to answer, Ricky. The way it happened for me was that way back in the 1970s, when I was at university in Aberdeen, I gradually became aware of things like poverty and environmental destruction. And, you know, typical of a young man, and anger comes up in you and you feel you want to do something about that. You then embark into the wider world and you find out how difficult it can be to do something about these things. In my own case, perhaps the most important time was in the 1990s, when I got involved with the land reform campaign on the Isle of Eigg and the campaign that stopped the proposed super quarry on the Isle of Harris. And there were times in those campaigns when I just felt it was so difficult. I was so lonely with what I was doing. It was so challenging to be challenging that I found myself reaching down to deeper levels of life, deeper levels from my own spiritual background, which on the Isle of Lewis, where I was raised, was a Presbyterian background. I now express it through the Quaker faith, but that Presbyterian background was very important also. A sense that we are not just walking alone, but we are being held in a cosmic hand, a divine hand, which carries us even when we don't know that we are being carried. That was what was important to me in those campaigns in the early days when they seemed like no hope campaigns.
So in a sense, you know, when you're writing this book, you're thinking about reaching out to the kind of person that you were that maybe needed something like this in the 90s and you felt a bit lonely. And did you have in mind, you know, a target audience of similar kind of people these days that you've come across that you think perhaps needed something like this?
Well, partly so, because in those two particular campaigns that I mentioned, they were both rooted in the Hebrides. And of course, in the Hebrides, both the Presbyterian and the Roman Catholic communities are deeply spiritual communities. So I knew that in digging into biblical material, for example, that I was speaking to an open door. I was speaking to a context that had the locks ready to be turned by those keys. But in the course of that, I found myself being pulled more and more deeply into those spiritualities and then applying them often in context of the world, which would be much more secular, where the approach based on spirituality would not be expected could take people by surprise and yet with surprising effect. For example, I'm thinking of the engagement I subsequently had with Lafarge, the biggest cement-making company in the world, where I served for 10 years on its corporate sustainability panel. Also the work that I do as a British military, where I lecture annually, twice a year now, on non-violence to senior officers. And what gets traction there is not putting over the political case for non-violence, but more putting over the spiritual case. This is a question of what we are as human beings. What does it mean if we choose to kill rather than to do our work in a way based upon non-violence?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the non-violence. Now, that's a chapter in your book. And I imagine with non-violence, I suppose with this particular chapter, there's a great fit with Christianity. Can I just to read a little bit out here? Because you have a lovely paragraph where you talk about Peter and Jesus saying to Peter, put your sword away, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. No more of this. And he also healed the servant ear of Malchus, the high priest official, thereby symbolically restoring the enemy's capacity to listen, the prerequisite for peace. I thought it was a lovely passage in the book, Alistair. And I'm guessing a lot of this, that kind of thought, has come out of these conversations that you've been able to have with people, for example, in the military.
Well, it has very much so. It's come from, you know, late night sessions in the officers' mess.
Yes.
Talking with people who have killed.
Yes.
And saying to them, as you know, you can say in that kind of intimate context over a drama to, you know, what is it like to be killed? How do you feel about it? One officer said to me, he said, I find I don't sleep so well. I get irritable more easily and I feel the cold more readily. And, you know, it just made me think how Dante described the inner circle of hell, not as being very hot, but as being very cold. And I've had situations there, for example, and you know, this is kind of what I mean by spiritual activism. I remember one day, just before I went on the platform to speak to 300 or 400 officers on the Advanced Command and Staff course, an Air Force officer just slipped out from the side and he came up to me and he said, I want to tell you, I'm just back from Afghanistan and I feel defiled. Wow. Now, there was no opportunity to ask in what way he felt defiled, whether he had done something or whether it had been what he had witnessed or whatever, whether this was an anti-war statement or a statement about the need for war in his view. There was no opportunity for that. But I just felt like something fly into me. And I just had to say to that man, whatever you've done, it is forgiven. Now walk on and get on with your life.
Amazing.
Now, I have no idea where, you know, did I have any right to say that? Should I, as a Quaker pacifist, be saying that to an army officer? It was just something that I felt moved in the moment. You might say moved by the spirit. And that's a kind of activist moment, that if you start to open yourself up to the possibility that we are more than just egos walking on legs, we're spiritual beings, that's the kind of thing that opens up to you.
It's an amazing story, Alistair. Let me just also ask about another thing, because I think you've gone to great pains also in that non-violent chapter to point out the truth about, as you see it, about the Prophet Muhammad, and peace be upon him, when you talk about how the roots of Islam are peaceful, but not necessarily pacifist.
Well, that's right. You see, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, I think we need to be respectful of other people's faiths and have interfaith appreciation, not just interfaith dialogue. The Prophet Muhammad was not a non-violent prophet any more than Moses was not non-violent or Joshua was not non-violent. However, there are passages in the Quran that both set a framework for just war, very similar to Christian just war theory. But even more than that, in chapter 5 of the Quran, where it tells its version of the Cain and Abel story, Cain comes to kill his brother Abel, and the reply of Abel is remarkable. Abel says, "You may lift up your hands to kill me, but I will not raise my arm to kill you, because I am a lover of God, the cherisher of the worlds." In other words, in the Quranic version, Abel chooses to die rather than to be killed. He sees that there is something greater that is about being connected to the divine. that is very profound non-violence, and one of the reasons we've written that into this book on spiritual activism is we want to help Islam to make itself understood and to be better understood, especially by us Christians, so that we defuse the tensions that are often caricatured as being a religious war between us.
Well, I think you've done a very good job with that. And I'll have to say, at the just for the outsider as well, that in each chapter you give a lovely, I'm flicking through the book here now, a nice case study at the end of every chapter, in which I think that's one of them as well. Little practical examples and lovely human stories with your co-author, Matt Carmichael.
My co-author, Matt Carmichael, a younger generation of activists. I'm 60 this year, Vicky. I'm starting to get on. But when I wrote this book, I was helped by a younger activist. He's young enough to be my son, based in Leeds, been involved very much in climate change activism. So the book is a melange of my teaching over the past quarter century in the Centre for Human Ecology on spiritual activism at Edinburgh and Strathclyde universities and the Open University, together with Matt's insights as a young person.
Well, thank you, Alistair. Stay with us because we're going to speak more in a second. But I'll just say that Spiritual Activism, Leadership as Service is published by Green Books. It's available now. In a moment, we are going to ask you, can you teach people to be happy? Not you personally, Alistair, but can we teach people to be happy? And we'll have your thoughts on that right after this. The Blue Nile there with Happiness. The Dalai Lama has given his blessing to a new course of evening classes available across the UK, which offer to teach people how to be happy. It's an 8-week course delivered through local groups aiming to reduce stress and increase happiness. And last week, a survey on the health and well-being of the UK came out, which rated the country in terms of where people felt most happiness, worthiness and life satisfaction. Apparently, folk are happiest in Fermanagh and Oma in Northern Ireland and least happy in Bolsover in Derbyshire. So now we know. But what is happiness? Is it something you can really teach? And is a pursuit of happiness a legitimate moral goal in itself? Let's explore that happily, I hope, with Alison Murdoch, who's a writer and student of Tibetan Buddhism, and Alistair McIntosh, who stayed with us. And good morning to you, Alison.
Good morning.
We talk a lot about happiness, about being happy, and you've written a book with 16 guidelines for a happy life. And how would you define it?
Well, sadly, I think it's easier, if one's going to be quick, to define it in terms of unhappiness. We all know what unhappiness feels like. When the mind is agitated, when we're stressed, when we're not in harmony with the people around us, when we don't feel satisfied, and when we don't feel there's very much meaning in our lives. So for me, happiness is the opposite of all of those. Happiness is when we do have a sense of what we're doing and what we're about. We do have good relationships with other people. We do have feel we have meaning, useful activity. And we can also, we have some calm inside of ourselves. We're playing to our strengths.
Alistair, have you had a chance to think about a definition that would work for you?
I think when I think about happiness, I remember way back in the 1970s, one of those posters that people would have on their walls, and it said, happiness is like a butterfly. If you chase it, you'll never catch it. But if you sit quietly, it might alight upon you.
I mean, do you think, you go back to the 70s and talk about that idea, but do you think, Alistair, this is a contemporary angst? Do you think that, you know, this idea, this pursuit of happiness is something that, you know, is a sort of, as it were, a first world problem?
Well, I think we have to be quite careful about pursuing happiness as an end in itself. Otherwise, we're chasing that butterfly. But happiness, I think, is something that comes when you live your life in a way that, as the prophet Micah puts it, you act justly, love tenderly, walk humbly with your God. Happiness is something that comes upon us as a side effect of what we're doing, rather than something that we set up hoping to achieve as a kind of reward for what we're doing.
I completely agree, Alistair, with the danger of happiness being consumerized, and I think it often is. I mean, I got a mailing yesterday from the store Homebase. The headline is, "Happiness is being inspired. Come to our DIY sale."
Retail therapy.
Exactly. It completely illustrates it. Whereas I'm with you. I mean, the Dalai Lama would say every time, you know, happiness is about kindness. It is about compassion.
Yes, yes.
But I think the difference slightly is that he would also say is the whole of life is about seeking happiness and avoiding suffering.
Yes.
Because we're talking about a very deep kind of happiness. We're talking about the kinds of things you do, building a useful, productive, helpful life, developing our positive qualities like kindness and compassion.
That's it. Yeah.
So I think, to me, it depends a little bit how we define it.
But Alison, is it a danger, both of you perhaps, that, you know, in this sort of PR blurb that's come out this week, it can come across a little bit as if, look, you've got this and you've got that, and you've got a couple of foreign holidays a year, but you know, what you really want is the final add-on is this happiness quotient that you're not getting. I mean, is there a sense in which, you know, that spin on it is a little bit unhelpful?
Well, I think culturally it kind of makes sense that a lot of us, and obviously not all of us, which is a really big issue, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere have got pretty comfortable lives, so we're not sitting there worrying how to put bread on the table for the next meal, and therefore, you know, calm and happiness becomes the next thing that we're seeking after. But actually, again, the Dalai Lama would be very strong on saying there's nothing wrong with having, you know, good food and pleasure and things like that, but really happiness is an inner thing, and we often find that people in less advantaged situations have actually got more satisfaction and strength of character and may even behave more altruistically than we do. So I don't think it's an add-on. I think it's actually a very important alternative to all the materialistic stuff.
Alistair.
Alison, I mean, surely you would agree that for people who do not have food on the table, for people queuing at food banks and so on, essentials like getting a meal into your belly is a prerequisite very often in order to be happy, and therefore we can't just look on happiness as something we add on when everything else is fulfilled.
Of course, I completely agree with you.
But let's explore that one a little bit, because I think what Alison's saying, Alistair, is an idea that must have occurred to you. It certainly occurred to me when I was in Brazil and visiting people, you know, who were in, you know, on an encampment by the roadside, who had ostensibly nothing that we would consider of any value, were waiting to be, you know, to have their own house, their own place,
yes,
and so on. And yet there was, you know, it always comes as a shock. Millions of people would say the same thing who've travelled from the West into any sort of third world place. Why is it when you encounter people who ostensibly have none of the things that you really value normally, that they often present as being very, very happy? Is it just simply a sense of contentment?
Well, in my experience, it's because they understand providence, they understand gratitude. You mentioned, Vicky, that Office of National Statistics survey, which was of 165,000 adults in Britain. And the happiest part of the UK was Fermanagh and Omagh. But the third happiest was the Outer Hebrides, which was also top for satisfaction in life and very high for feeling that the things that residents in the area do with their lives are worthwhile. Now, how do we explain the fact that the Outer Hebrides have below average national incomes? You've got quite a lot of income poverty and yet such high levels of happiness or satisfaction. Same, I would imagine, with Northern Ireland, not one of the richest parts of Britain. And I think it's to do with having an attitude that understands providential grace, that understands that reaching out and trying to grasp for things, as the Buddhists teach, it's when you reach out and try to hold on, you try to cling on to things, that's when you bring unhappiness on you. Whereas if you, you know, act justly, love tenderly, walk humbly with your God or with the Buddha nature, as the Buddhists would have it, then these things come to you in ways which, even though outwardly you may have very little, inwardly you can be very rich. And I would imagine that that is what the Dalai Lama would be endorsing in these training programs.
I'm sure Alison will confirm that either way. But let me ask this as well, Alison, about Buddhist teaching. Does it suggest that people can train themselves to be happier and can find it within themselves? And if so, how is that achieved?
Yeah, it definitely does. And I like the way the vocabulary you're using in terms of training yourself, because actually at the beginning of the programme we were talking about courses that teach people to be happy. And I think that's actually a misnomer. I know the people who created that course, and what they would say is that it's giving people resources to learn themselves and train themselves how to be happy. And Mark, who created the course, said last week, well, actually, the top bits, when they were trialling it, the people's favourite bits were when people discussed their own issues together. So I think it's something we very much have to take responsibility for ourselves. It's about us saying that, you know, happiness isn't something ready-made, it comes from our actions. And we're actually going to give this some attention, you know, amid all the different things that you could do of an evening, all the different classes out there, activities or whatever, just spending a little bit of time learning what, from a scientific and a philosophical point of view, other people think will contribute to happiness, you know, is a really good use of your time. And I think that's what the course is based on. And there are four, there's a neuroscientist called Richard Davidson who's worked a lot with the Dalai Lama, and he, according to his work on the brain, there are four scientifically proven components of well-being or happiness. One of them is resilience, which I think links into people on low incomes who we've been talking to. Another is noticing positive moments instead of ignoring them. Another is the ability to pay attention, which a lot of us, you know, struggle with in our current society. And the fourth one, interestingly enough, is generosity or altruism. And that's what produces the most direct positive results in terms of our state of mind.
Very interesting. Would it be true also, and Alison can comment on this because you'll know who I'm talking about as well, that the chief medical officer in Scotland up until quite recently was Sir Harry Burns, and he talked about this idea of health as, you know, the well-being of people was also to do with happiness. It was to do with being connected to families, to support networks and so on. So is happiness in itself as well also an important part of our public health program?
What Professor Harry Burns has said about health, and he's now Professor of Global Health Policy at Strathclyde University, so he's still very active on these issues, is that the more we can reduce stress in life, the more our cortisol levels fall in our bloodstream, and the more fulfilled we become and less prone to diseases, as I understand what he's saying.
Sure.
Now, that is vitally important insight at the level of, as Alison just said, at the level of science. But I think there's a missing dimension to a lot of the discussion about happiness, that we are, I think, on the wrong path if we think that we can work it out for ourselves. And in that respect, you know, I rest back into my Presbyterian roots in the Isle of Lewis, where probably like yourself, Ricky, I was of the era where in school and church we would get taught the Westminster Shorter Catechism, of which the first question is, what is the chief end of man? And the answer is ever so interesting. Man's chief end, humankind's chief purpose, is to glorify God and enjoy God forever. So, you know, it's a question of cart and horses. Do you seek first all these other things, or do you seek first the kingdom of heaven? The chief end is to glorify God, to enter, as Buddhists might say, into the fullness of the Buddha nature, the interconnectedness with all being, with all of life. And then all of these things will come unto you. Then you will enjoy God forever.
Well, I'll just say from a Buddhist point of view, what they say is the two most important things are compassion and wisdom. And the two together are like wings of a bird. So if you don't have both wings, you don't get off the ground. And we can all see that our compassion needs to be informed by common sense and, you know, deep thought. And, you know, we need to constantly be trying to understand better who we are, how we think, how we function, and what's our relationship with the world. So in a general answer to what Alistair's been saying, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, we don't believe in a creator God. But what we do believe is that there are deeper and deeper levels of mind and wisdom to be accessed within ourselves. And so I think, again, there's a danger when we talk about happiness that we're firing off from this very chattery top level of the mind. And actually, exactly as Alistair says, it's a case of going deeper and more humbly inside of ourselves.
And what's so wonderful, Alison, was that, was in Buddhism, as I understand it, is that right at the heart of Buddhism, you have this understanding of interconnectedness through the Buddha nature, what we Christians would call Christ within, and that the word that gets translated from the Tibetan from that is a Tathagatagarbha. Tathagata meaning beyond space and time, and the Gava meaning the embryo, the womb, the seedbed out of which reality arises, which is why, in my take, Buddhists and Christians at the deepest and most mystical level are basically saying much the same thing.
It's lovely to hear you say that. One of my favourite quotes, I used to have it at the bottom of all my emails, is dwelling deep inside every being without exception is an inexhaustible source of compassion and wisdom.
Amen.
Well, on that lovely, happy note, we shall leave that discussion. Many thanks, Alison Murdoch and Alistair McIntosh. In a few minutes, I'll hear from a man who's been happily building a temporary shed in his garden, and I'll find out why after this from Carole King.